Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome to Legal Face Off. This is our final show of 2018. It seems like the year flew by, Tina Martini.
It sure does, Rich Linkoff.
Well, we're very excited to have lots of great guests today. We're covering a lot of breaking issues. I thought that this last couple weeks of December, Tina, would be slow, but there are a ton of breaking legal issues to cover, so I'm excited to dive right in. We've got, first up, the Michael Flynn sentencing hearing today. We've got Arun Rao, who is president of IGI. He is also an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. He previously served in the Department of Justice and also in the Obama administration in the office of the White House counsel. We are very pleased to have Arun Rao on Legal Face Off.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So earlier today, Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor to President Trump, was in a federal court in Washington, D.C., explaining that he did not feel entrapped by FBI agents, contrary to perhaps what the president thinks. Bring us up to speed on what's going on with Michael Flynn today.
Well, we had some unusual developments in what was supposed to be a sentencing hearing today. As you know, the sentencing did not go forward. And I think it's safe to say that it was a bit unexpected that it didn't go forward. As you mentioned a moment ago, the president had tweeted suggesting that General Flynn may have been entrapped, or at least referencing to some comments that had been made in a sentencing memo that had been submitted. And I think that suggestion in General Flynn's sentencing memo was not received well by Judge Emmett Sullivan. Judge Sullivan has a reputation of being very independent-minded, and I think we could see that today. He expressed some severe displeasure at any suggestion that the defendant had been entrapped. And as you pointed out, General Flynn quickly backed away from that. On a number of occasions, Judge Sullivan suggested to the defendant that he may be well served to request another delay in sentencing, which to me suggests that he was not, that the judge was not in a position in which he was prepared to honor the parties, essentially with the parties' joint request here, which was a non-jail disposition. Reading between the lines, it seemed as though Judge Sullivan was strongly leaning towards imposing some kind of jail time.
But what was really interesting is that it seemed, based on at least some of the accounts that we read, that the judge was coming on pretty strong against Flynn in the one instance, and then he sort of backed off later on. I mean, do you care to comment on him? He was almost apologetic when he ended up coming out and saying that, you know, he was offering to delay the sentencing. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think, Tina, what you're referring to is there was a moment in which Judge Flynn asked for some time to consult with his attorneys after repeated prompting by Judge Sullivan, and there was a recess. Given that I think the comments that you're referring to by Judge Sullivan, where he sort of backed off from his initial statements, came after that break, he may have had the opportunity to sort of view some of the coverage of the proceedings up to that point, and perhaps recognize that he may have overstated and at least misstated a few things. The one that really struck me was the reference to treason. One of the prosecutors, Brandon Van Grack, I think was asked by Judge Sullivan whether what General Flynn had engaged in was treason. And I, there is, as I think Mr. Van Grack ultimately said, you know, there's a very technical definition of treason, and you know, that is a, I don't know whether when Judge Sullivan made that initial comment, he was referring it to in the legal sense or in the colloquial sense, but I think after that break, it was clear that he had probably reconsidered some of the things he'd said and wanted to make sure the record was clear.
Yeah, and to that point, let's read the quote, because what the judge said, it sounded like he was very impassioned. He said, "You were an unregistered agent of a foreign country while serving as the national security advisor to the president. Arguably," and this is where treason, you know, comes in, "arguably, this undermines everything this flag over here stands for. Arguably, you sold your country out. The court is going to consider all that. I am not hiding my disgust, my disdain for your criminal offense." Pretty strong language, and again, arguably pointing to treason.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think it's important to note that there's a specific legal definition of treason, and it seems to me that in light of the full quote that you just described, that Judge Sullivan may have meant it more in the colloquial sense of being sort of unpatriotic, right, rather than as having committed a legal offense of treason, which is a separate question entirely, and which I think is one ultimately that the department attorneys, Mr. Van Grack, was comfortable saying that, you know, the government did not feel that he had satisfied the legal definition of treason.
So, Arun, you referenced earlier the fact that the judge was on the verge, seemingly, of actually sentencing Michael Flynn to jail. This is despite Flynn a little over a year ago reaching a plea deal where prosecutors were recommending no jail time in exchange or citing his substantial assistance to investigators. You've been in these situations before in your time as a federal prosecutor. Bring us inside that room. And you know, we hear all the time that these are merely recommendations. And, of course, a federal judge can decide on their own what to do. But, you know, what's that look like when you're negotiating these agreements? Do you assume the judge is going to concur with you? Do you work that out with the judge beforehand? Do you sort of know, depending on what judge you get, how likely that judge is to follow your recommendations? What's the inside scoop on that?
You know, it's certainly not discussed explicitly with the judge ahead of time. As a matter of fact, I think any good prosecutor would tell you you're very careful to let any cooperating defendant know that the ultimate question of sentence is one for the court. It's not one for the prosecutors. Even in the rare proceedings under federal law where the parties agree to a sentence, the judge can sometimes choose to disregard that and permit the defendant the opportunity to withdraw his or her guilty plea. You know, in this case, I think, as I mentioned before, Judge Sullivan is a very independent-minded judge. He is most famous, I think, for his presiding over the trial of Ted Stevens. In that case, he actually ended up dismissing the indictment after a verdict was rendered against the senator. And I bring that up as an illustration of his independent-mindedness. In the typical situation, in my experience, in a case in which the government and the defendant are jointly recommending a sentence, my experience at least has been that judges are likely to accord that significant weight. But it is not unprecedented for a judge to reject that recommendation. And in this case, some of the language that Judge Sullivan was using, I believe he used the word disgust at one point, that to me suggests that he felt that the recommendation, both by the prosecutors, perhaps of the guidelines themselves, didn't adequately capture the gravity of the offense in this case. I think it was by and large unexpected that we would be sitting here today without General Flynn sentenced, but it's not totally out of the realm of possibility because you know, sentencing is the province of the court, and you know, you again, as a good prosecutor, you're always very careful to say, look, whatever recommendations we're making, it's only that, it's a recommendation, it's not a promise, and no one can promise what the sentence is going to be. The only person who can make that decision is the judge.
That's Arun Rao. He is president of IGI Investigative Group International. The website is IGINT.com. He's also a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, former federal prosecutor. Arun, please come back on Legal Face-Off and keep us posted on developments involving Flynn and all of the other issues involving the Mueller investigation.
Thank you for the invitation. I very much enjoyed it, and best to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, too.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Face-Off since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
Next up on Legal Face-Off, of course, follow us on social media, Facebook,
Twitter,
LinkedIn, MySpace. I know Tina Martini's big
Instagram.
On
Instagram.
We are next covering the Affordable Care Act. Big news over the last few days, Friday specifically. The ACA was ruled unconstitutional. We're going to dive into that subject with a couple of experts on the subject. First, we've got Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School, Professor Abby Gluck. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got George Mason University, Antonin Scalia Law School, Professor of Law Ilya Soman as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, so as I said, U.S. District Court Reed O'Connor, who was a George W. Bush appointee, on Friday ruled that the Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional. He sided with the claims of 20 Republican-led states that brought a lawsuit seeking to strike down the law. Professor Gluck, could you please explain the basis of the judge's decision?
Okay, so the decision is really about two different things. On the one hand, the decision is about the so-called individual mandate, which is that requirement in the Affordable Care Act that we all get ourselves insured or we pay a tax. That so-called insurance purchase mandate has been unpopular. It was the subject of the 2012 Supreme Court challenge. And when Congress failed to repeal the whole statute, what it did in 2017 was it eliminated the penalty for failure to comply with that mandate, effectively making that mandate unenforceable. So on the one hand, the suit nominally asked the court whether the mandate is even constitutional anymore without an enforceable penalty. And the reason it asked that question is that the Supreme Court in that 2012 challenge held the mandate to be constitutional precisely because of Congress's taxing power to enact it. So without the penalty, the argument goes, there's no congressional power hook to support the mandate, and it should be gone. Now, if that were the only question in the case, it would be kind of academic because the mandate is already unenforceable and the markets have already absorbed an Affordable Care Act without the mandate. But the kicker, and the reason the case is getting so much attention, is that what Texas and the 19 other states have done, it's gone to the judge and said, what's more, without this mandate, once you hold the mandate unconstitutional, the rest of the statute has to go. All 2,000 pages, everything from the Medicaid expansion to Medicare drug payment reform to calorie labeling counts, everything goes down with that ship. That's what makes the case sort of jaw-dropping and why it's gotten so much coverage.
So the ruling essentially leaves decisions on implementing the law to the states in the near term. How do you think the states will react, Professor Selman?
So I don't know that they'll react enormously immediately, because there's a good likelihood that at least the severability part of this ruling is going to be overruled. Obviously, those states that want to preserve the ACA, the 16 of them who have intervened in the case to defend it, they are going to pursue avenues of appeal to the Fifth Circuit, the Court of Appeals that oversees this particular district judge. And while there might be some complex procedural questions about exactly when that appeal will happen, I think it will occur in the next few months. And at that point, we will get to know whether this ruling is overruled. I do think the severability part very likely will be overruled. And from a policy point of view, for reasons Abby said, that's the part that most people are most interested in. I do think that they may well not overrule the part relating to what's left of the individual mandate. And while that doesn't matter very much for the ACA, I think it does have some, or would have some, valuable precedential significance for other issues.
Professor Gluck, you have opined that Congress did not intend the, or put another way, what's your feelings on how this case deals with what Congress intended in this 2,000-page law?
What Ilya was just referring to, the severability ruling, and I should point out that Ilya and I actually filed a brief together in this case, so we are in agreement on this particular point of view, which is also interesting about the case, in that you've got law professors with different approaches to the law coming together in defense of some of these sort of subtle, more basic principles. So the principle that Ilya was talking about, severability, is this principle that tells a court what to do when it pulls out as unconstitutional one provision of a statute. The question is, what happens to the rest of it? Does it stay standing? And the settled doctrine is that the courts aim to preserve rather than destroy. The presumption is leave more standing. Plus, the cornerstone is congressional intent. Would Congress have wanted the statute to stand without the provision that was taken away? Our point in our brief, and what I think there is a broad consensus for at this point, except for the judge himself, is that in this case, we don't have to guess what Congress wanted, because the 2017 Congress is the one that reduced the mandate penalty to zero, made the mandate basically defunct, and left the rest of the statute standing. That should have been the end of the matter for this case. The judge really had no business trying to hypothesize what Congress wished it could have done if it had the votes, because all that matters is what the 2017 Congress did. It left the rest of the ACA standing, and that should have been the end of the story.
So, Professor Selman, why did the judge do that in this case? Many are interpreting his decision as just raw politics, right? I mean, this judge has a history, and there's a history of forum shopping to pick this judge, given his prior rulings. Why do you think the judge acted this way?
So I can't get into his head with any certainty. When judges make badly flawed rulings, as I think this one is, I don't think we necessarily have to attribute crass motives to them. Many times they just screw up, just like the rest of us screw up in various aspects of our lives. If you read the judge's opinion, in his view, what really matters is not what the 2017 Congress wanted, but what the original Congress that enacted the ACA back in 2010 thought. And there they did make findings and lots of statements saying that the individual mandate was essential to the overall structure of the law, as also the Obama administration and others said at the time. And then the judge says, well, in 2017, they didn't repeal those statements, and they didn't opine or make any findings on the mandate and its significance then. So he says, well, those 2010 findings, therefore, must stand. I think the obvious problem with this line of argument is that all of those statements and findings from 2010 relate to the original version of the mandate, which did have a penalty. It just doesn't make any sense to think that the 2017 Congress or anybody believed that a mandate without a penalty, the one that exists now, is actually essential to the overall structure of the law. You might argue that the law will function worse without an effective mandate. I think, you know, it was having significant problems even before, but perhaps it'll function worse now. But to the extent that's the case, that's a decision Congress made in 2017, and whatever findings are made back in 2010, I think they're not relevant to the mandate as it currently exists, as opposed to one that was created in the original ACA.
So, Professor Gluck, last question. We've talked a lot about this particular case. Are there any other cases or challenges to the ACA that are worth mentioning for our listeners, things that we should be looking forward to seeing play out in the coming weeks and months?
I mean, yeah, the Affordable Care Act is sort of the legal gift that never stops giving. There are lots of cases pending right now. I'll mention just a couple quickly. There's actually a parallel case pending in Maryland right now where the Maryland Attorney General went to court for a declaration that the statute is constitutional even without the mandate. It's kind of the mirror image of the Texas case. We don't know if that case is going to be held as we watch the Texas case move through the courts, but it's a case that aims to tell the exact story initiated by a blue state that supports the statute. There are also a bunch of cases now in the courts that are challenging various aspects of the administration's regulatory scheme, a variety of executive orders and rules the administration has promulgated or that are aimed to ostensibly give consumers more choice, but also have the effect of splitting up the insurance markets in ways that some people argue are contrary to the text of the statute. So on the one hand, we've got this assault on the Affordable Care Act by Texas. On the other hand, we've got a bunch of other people challenging the Trump administration on the grounds of how it's implementing the act, that it's implementing the act in ways that aren't faithful to the act's text and structure. So it's never boring when you're following the ACA, and they're keeping the courts very busy.
Professor Ilya Soman from George Mason University, Twitter at Ilya Soman. And he also writes a blog called The Vola Conspiracy for The Reason magazine. And Professor Abby Gluck from Yale Law School. Not only are they ACA experts, but they're former classmates at Yale Law School back in the day. We are very privileged to have you both on Legal Face-Off. And please come back and update us as this issue progresses.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
We all know the legal world is complex and high pressure. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com. Welcome back to our last story before we get to our grab bag and some very special guests. Joining us now is Kenan Lambert. He is a return guest on Legal Face-Off, very noted, well-respected trial attorney here in Chicago. He's covered some other stories that he's been involved with in the past, but today he's here to talk about a client of his and a film that he's involved with called Say Her Name, The Life and Death of Sandra Bland. It is an HBO documentary. It's an excellent story, and we're really privileged to have Kenan Lambert back on the show. Kenan,
welcome.
Thank
you so much for having me. Thank you so much. Good to be back.
So we covered Sandra Bland's story on this show back when it happened, but give our listeners a quick summary of the story, and then we'll talk about the film a little bit.
Sure. A lot of people will remember she was a Chicagoland native who went down to Texas, got pulled over for failing to use a traffic stop, and as a consequence, ended up being made to get out of her car. She was threatened with a taser where the officer in San Diego told her he would light her up. A dispute ensued. She ended up on the ground, thrown in jail, and 3 days later was found hanging in a Texas jail cell. There was a big, huge uproar, obviously, because of the way she was treated and some real serious concerns about what actually happened to her in the jail, whether or not she was murdered or instead committed suicide.
Yeah, you know, I watched the almost the entire video today, the traffic stop video, or at least the relevant portion. The video is about 45 minutes long, at least the one I saw. And, you know, Sandra Bland's on there for about 20 minutes. And I'll just say on record that I'm a big supporter of the police. And I think frequently a lot of the stories that you hear, the police really don't get fair coverage. But I'll tell you, when watching this video, Cannon, I was angry. You know, I just felt very angry looking at the way things went down, and not to relitigate, you know, that case, but I think it's central to the entire film. I was angry watching how this, as you mentioned, devolves from a simple traffic stop, which, by the way, who knows if there was probable cause to stop her? I don't think that's clear. But really it devolved from a turn signal, stop to, you know, pretty violent arrest. And ultimately, as you mentioned, you know, 3 days later, this woman was dead. So watching the video today, I was really struck by that. I can only imagine that the film goes into more detail very poignantly about that.
It does. And like you, I'm a supporter of the police, too. When there's something that happens that I want to be able to call the police, and I want to be able to know that the police will be there for me. And I know that they are, generally speaking. And I think the reality is that most good police officers have a tough time with what happened to Sandy. The film does go into a great bit of detail about a lot of things that, frankly, a lot of people that think they know about the case, they find out after watching the film, they didn't know nearly what's to be known. And it's the filmmakers did an exceptional job in putting things together. They actually had occasion to speak to the jailers and the DA down in Waller County, and they get from their own words and their own mouths their perspective. So it's a balanced film, and HBO really did a great job with it.
So tell us a little bit more about the film and the story about Sandra personally that the directors of the film are trying to tell, and also who didn't contribute to the film. For example, the state trooper who is no longer in law enforcement, my understanding is that he's at least understandably not part of the story. What is the legacy that we're trying to preserve here with this film?
So first and foremost, one of the things that I think that is so extraordinary about the film is that through Sandy's own words, who narrates the situation, you kind of get a real solid glimpse of who she was. She was an activist. She was very interested in seeing young kids succeed. And so she had a lot of energy that she devoted toward that objective. As to why it is that certain people were not contacted, you know, for example, the sheriff was contacted and communicated and participated in the film. So too did the DA. But you're correct that with respect to the trooper, Officer Encinia, he did not, though they requested his input, and though they sought his, sought him out. He just, for whatever his reasons were, chose not to. But I think that the biggest legacy that that this leaves is that people have to be prepared to stand up, and that people have to know and appreciate that there's nothing wrong with being prepared to stand for what it is that you know to be right, and that we as a society have to be prepared to demand that we get treated appropriately, fairly, and that where that doesn't happen, we should speak to it.
Cannon, is this the first time you've been involved with a film? I know you've got obviously a long track record of representing the rights of your clients in many different situations. Is this the first time you've been involved with a film? And if so, why do you think film is a, you know, appropriate medium to get the message out? As someone myself who's been involved with some films and produced a documentary, I think it's, you know, an excellent way to get a message out. What's your feeling on that as a medium to, you know, send a message?
Well, so candidly, when HBO approached me about it, it wasn't something that I was altogether in love with doing. The reality of it was, for me, I was just focused on the litigation, the case. But one of the principal tenets to which I was brought in was, look, the family wanted to make sure that Sandy was never forgotten, and it was a vehicle for them to make certain that could take place. And so it was beneficial in that regard. The family didn't get paid. I didn't get paid. As you know, in a documentary, you can't be paid because you want to be in a position where it's authentic and it's balanced. But I think that when it's all said and done, looking back on it now, I think it will do exactly what Ms. Geneva and her daughters wanted to see happen, and that is make sure that people don't forget Sandy.
So to that point, there's been some coverage about Sandy's sisters and her family still searching for answers. What in your mind is still left unresolved here?
Boy, I promise you this. If you don't remember anything else that I say here, I promise you, if you watch this film, you will understand why there are still so many questions, why it is so hard for this family to come to grips with the official version that they've been given. This film does a great job in making clear how it is that so many have such huge, huge unresolved issues with what happened to Sandy. I don't want to kind of spoil it, but there are, I can only tell you that you will not watch this film and not feel anger. You'll laugh. You'll be perplexed. You'll be in disbelief. I guarantee it.
Well, not only is it interesting, it's just a great piece of filmmaking. So take a look at it. It's called Say Her Name, The Life and Death of Sandra Bland. It's available on HBO. That is our friend Cannon Lambert. Website is, of course, getthecannon.com. You can't forget that one. Cannon Lambert, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off, and please come back.
Thank you so much.
You all, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
We turn now, Tina, to one of our favorite segments on Legal Face-Off, the
LGB
Legal Grab Bag. We've got two amazing guests, seven compelling stories.
Always compelling.
Our first guest in studio is Jasmine Cooper.
Hello,
hello. WGN producer. Give a plug for your various roles here and your social media presence. Go ahead, Jasmine. Old friend of the show, by the way.
I have been with WGN for almost 5 years now.
Wow.
Wow, yeah. I am a dinosaur here.
A unicorn.
A beautiful dinosaur.
I guess a beautiful dinosaur. I also do Boo Love and Wendy Snyder Show. I'm their midday producer. And I'm excited to be here. My Twitter, Instagram is Chi-Town Radio Jazz, and that's C-H-I, Town Radio, and it's J-A-Z.
A prolific social media person. And Brian McManus, who is the opposite. Well, you're on Facebook. I see you on Facebook. Do you have the Twitter over there at McManus Law Offices?
I don't have the Twitter. I leave that to President Trump.
Yes.
It's good to be here, Rich. I'm especially ecstatic because Rich and I have had a chance to practice law over decades, and it's nice to be here, and it's nice to be invited, and I'm looking forward to it.
Brian's a good friend, great lawyer here in Chicago, practices personal injury, workers' compensation law at Brian J. McManus & Associates, and a man of many opinions, so it's going to be a compelling few minutes here. All right, so first story on Legal Face-Off is really interesting story that's developing as we speak. Of course, President Trump is involved, as he often is. There was a Army Special Forces officer named Matthew Goldstein, who President Trump 2 days ago said was a war hero and should not be convicted of murder. Why is this special forces officer charged with murder? Well, it's kind of a long story, but he was in Afghanistan. He was a captain in 2010, and there were two Marines who were killed by a roadside bomb. And according to an investigation, his team took the alleged bomber into their base. Now, at the base, the bomber ran into a local tribal leader who had been cooperating with the good guys. He'd been cooperating with the army officers. Now, Captain Goldstein felt that the tribal leader's life was in danger because of this, you know,
the bomber
observation,
seeing him,
the bomber
right.
seeing him. So he thought that would present a great risk to not only his tribal leader's life, but would allow this alleged bomber to commit additional acts of terror. So, according to the allegation, Captain Goldstein and another soldier took the bomb maker off base, executed him, and buried his body in a shallow grave. He then helped dig out the body so it could be incinerated in the base trash pit. He admitted to the killing in a Fox News interview in 2016. And fast forward to this week, he was charged with murder. President Trump has come out and said that this person was a war hero and raised the possibility of pardoning him. The question before us and before the court is whether it's actually murder or whether he was justified in executing what we all agree was a pretty bad person who represents a security risk to, you know, not just the base, or represented a risk not just to the base, but to, you know, lots of people. I've read a lot about this in the last, you know, day or so, and actually talked to a couple of experts. And I think it's an easy case from my perspective. Mm-hmm. I think it's clear that he executed this person. There are certainly rules of engagement involved here, and I think it's bedrock legal and military principle that you can't execute someone in custody. You know, whether he represented a risk or not, I think it's clear from my perspective, limited that it is, that you can't just decide on your own to execute someone in the manner that this happened. So,
well, I think also one thing that was mentioned in what I read was that the order had come down to release this guy too. So it wasn't that, I mean, he was in custody but about to be released. And I think that that was probably part of the decision-making process. And I agree with you, Rich, that ultimately there are rules of engagement and so forth, but there were alternatives here. They could have opted to keep him in custody rather than release him pending further investigation or something along those lines, so that he could hopefully not be in a danger to this local tribal leader, but not be executed either.
And the risk, absolutely. And the risk, of course, is that, you know, the reason that you want to have these standards, even in a time of war, is that you don't want people treating American prisoners of war this way, right? I mean, there's a lot greater risk that Americans will be treated poorly. So the reason that you uphold these standards is to avoid that. Jasmine, what are your thoughts on this whole story?
I actually agree with both of you all. Like, I would say, look at the other side. Would you treat someone from your country that same way? I think that's just simple night and day. But once again, we're talking about this right now. So that's how I feel on that.
Brian, what are your thoughts on this? Murder?
Well, we all can agree that this guy was a prisoner at the time he was killed. He's not an armed combatant when he's killed. He's a prisoner. Everything that's being talked about, Captain Goldstein and his record, is all well and good. He seems like he's represented his country well, except in this instance. But those are all mitigating factors. Those are all be things that we'd talk about at the sentencing of Captain Goldstein rather than at the trial of him for this particular event. So what he had done in his past, although relevant, isn't relevant to the crime, Rich. I would say it's relevant to the punishment that's handed down to him when taken into consideration his services to his country.
I think it's a good point. And, you know, are we concerned, by the way? I mean, not that this would be the first time that Trump would give us concern about something legal, but there's something called the separation of powers here, right? And for Trump to step in a matter of a trial that's certainly a legal issue, that's certainly a military issue, when he really doesn't know the facts, right? I mean, all he knows is, oh, yeah, there's someone who killed a bad guy, right, in the simplistic way that Trump looks at things. And let me tweet about it. Just a ridiculous precedence. I mean, there's precedence before that Trump has done this, right? In the Bo Bergdahl case, he tweeted that, you know, he was, I think he called him a rat, or, you know, he called him some name. You know, there's a history in the past of presidents avoiding these kind of high-profile cases involving the military. I think there's a good reason for that. So, again,
well,
Trump
he makes
has,
up for that by jumping headfirst into it.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to a story that is local in one respect, but actually getting national attention. We've got an alderman here. His name is Ed Burke. Speaking of dinosaurs, he is the longest-serving alderman in Chicago political history. He heads up the 14th Ward here in Chicago. And not once, but twice, his office was raided by FBI agents in the last two or three weeks. Tina, bring us up to speed on Alderman Burke.
Yes. So last week, FBI agents, as you said, Rich, raided the City Hall and Ward offices of Alderman Ed Burke for the second time in 2 weeks. As part of that raid, and in a very dramatic showing that we all saw on local news, the agents papered over the doors and windows of his office to keep anyone from seeing what was going on inside. While the first raid was not considered all that unusual, and he has experienced similar raids in the past, the fact that this second raid happened so quickly on the heels of the first is what's really raised some eyebrows, as well as the fact that we still don't really know what's going on and what really precipitated the raid. So we saw, as part of the first raid, a bunch of hard drives, computer monitors, and boxes being taken out by law enforcement agents. What's interesting is that one news source that I saw speculated and was wondering if this could somehow be linked to his legal practice. He has done a lot of property tax assessment work in this local area known as our lovely city of Chicago.
Including some work for
none other than President Trump.
Yes.
And Trump Tower.
To Trump, right.
Yeah, it all circles back. Yeah, there's like a quarter of a degree of separation there. And what's interesting is that I think earlier this year he ceased representing President Trump. So I think some people are wondering and speculating about that. And the news broke earlier today about Toni Preckwinkle. I'm not sure if you all saw that, but apparently she's planning to donate the $12,800 in contributions that she got from Alderman Burke to various nonprofits. And she really came out swinging today.
They're all jumping ship because, you know, listen, when you're in the city council in Chicago for 25 years, you're going to interact with almost everybody. And he is the mentor for a lot of aldermen. Susana Mendoza, who's the comptroller who's running for mayor, last night was distancing herself, even though she acknowledged that Burke was one of her mentors. They're all backing away. But a couple of interesting takeaways from this story before we jump to Brian and Jasmine. First of all, he was first interviewed wearing a trench coat and like a fedora. You know, like not a good look if you're trying to avoid suspicion. That's like,
but it's a good look for our producer, Ben.
That's true. That's true. And also, Ed Burke said, you know, you said that he had been investigated before. He said, well, yes, I've always cooperated and intend to cooperate with the FBI. Oh, really? Is there an opportunity to not? Like, if the feds come knocking on your door and put brown paper on your window, is there an option to say, yeah, I don't want to cooperate? I wasn't aware of that in the federal guidelines that you could just say, I don't want to cooperate. But, Brian, what are your thoughts? I mean, you're involved a little bit in politics, I know, and you know lots of folks here in the city. What is behind this Ed Burke investigation? Does it relate to his chairing of the Finance Committee, which governs the $100 million workers' compensation system here for the city of Chicago? Lots of people are pointing to that.
Tina pointed it out, and she made a very good point. We don't know what it's about. We don't know, is it about Trump? Is it about the workers' compensation system? Is it about his job as the Committee on Finance? I will tell you one thing, though, Rich. It reminds me of the line from The Hustler in the movie when Paul Newman says, I don't rattle, kid. Ed Burke walked out, looked like he didn't rattle.
Yeah.
So that's a guy who,
like he you knows said, where the bodies are buried.
Has dealt with the FBI on a few occasions, and certainly didn't look like somebody that was overly intimidated by what was going on.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, on the other hand, though, and a lot of the mayoral candidates have said this, that it might be time for him just to go.
Right.
You know, he's chaired this important finance committee for years. It's time for some new blood. And, you know, he went through the aldermanic wars with Mayor Washington back in the day. He was a very vocal opponent to Mayor Washington. He's created a lot of friends at City Hall over the years, but I think it's probably time for him to go. All right, let's move on to another well-known Chicago political figure. That'll be Rod Blagojevich. In the last few days, his wife, Patty Blagojevich, was on Fox News talking about how her husband was the victim of a witch hunt.
Boy, sound this familiar? Terminology just sounds really familiar.
Yeah, Patty said that it's a very dirty business when these prosecutors, with their unchecked power and no oversight over them all, can go after any politician they want. All they have to do is look back at what they did to my husband 10 years ago. We're just about at the 10-year anniversary, by the way, of that fateful morning when Rod Blagojevich was taken into custody by agents at his home. And then Trump, of course, came out and tweeted that the interview with Patty was required watching, and that if this doesn't tell you something about what has been going on in our country, nothing will. And, of course, very sad. The overall question here is, will Trump pardon Blagojevich? We've covered this extensively with Blagojevich's lawyers on our show. What do we think, Tina Martini? Is Blago getting out?
I don't think so.
But it's a witch hunt.
Yeah, but still.
It's very sad.
It is very sad. But you know what? I think if he was going to pardon him, he would have done it already. And while he's, you know, expressing whatever kind of empathy he can as president, ultimately I think that he would have acted already if he was planning on pardoning him. But that's just my gut on it.
Yeah, I agree as well.
Jasmine, what are your thoughts? Because Trump has actually gone on record saying that what he does not justify 18 years in jail. By the way, it was 14 years and not 18 years. But Trump has gone on record saying that he got treated unfairly. Do you think Trump will step in as a last resort for Blago?
I don't believe so, because he hasn't done it. He's been talking about this for a long time. And we know with Trump, if he's talking about it, he wants it done. But he's like a big baby. He's like, oh, my gosh, nobody's paying attention to me. I said what I said. And like his tweet, very sad. I don't believe that this will happen. He's just going to have to pay the time.
Brian?
I guess the only thing I'm surprised is that Patty Blagojevich didn't bring it up in a tweet.
You're right.
In a tweet and get a tweet back. I wouldn't be surprised, Rich and Tina, if you saw a pardon coinciding with some other political move that the president wanted to make in a means of covering up what he really wanted to do by creating news about Rod Blagojevich, who I think everybody's kind of made up their mind about.
Yeah, I think there's actually a pretty good chance that he does do this. And technically, I think the term is clemency, but I think he does step in. You know, Trump has obviously shown no care for the rule of law and abiding by a sentence handed down by a judge. Whether you agree or disagree, I happen to disagree that he should have received that long a sentence. But whether you agree or disagree, it was the result of not one, but actually two trials. Trump obviously, you know, doesn't care too much about the legal process, as we've seen. All right, moving on to Robin Thicke, the son of a fellow Canadian. So I always love
Alan
that story, because Alan is Canadian.
Didn't he die?
Alan Thicke is, in fact, not with us anymore. Died about a year or two ago. But Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams were sued, and just this past few days, the case is finally over as a result of a verdict. Tell us more about it, Tina.
So many of us, particularly those IP lawyers like me among us, have been closely watching what's been called the Blurred Lines litigation, which finally ended this week with a total judgment of nearly $5 million against both Robin Thicke as well as Pharrell Williams, and in favor of the estate of Marvin Gaye. So just scrolling back to 2013, the hit song Blurred Lines was released and was subsequently hit with a copyright infringement suit. The estate of Marvin Gaye claimed that the song was very, very close to Got to Give It Up, which was one of Marvin Gaye's hits. In 2015, the estate was awarded more than $7 million. And that amount was later reduced to $5.3 million. Both Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams appealed, and a California judge upheld the jury's decision earlier this year. On December 6th, which was a few days ago now, the breakdown of the damages had come out and was released. The judge ordered both Thicke as well as Williams and his publishing company to pay the estate almost $3 million. Thicke was ordered to pay an additional $1.76 million, and Pharrell Williams and his publishing company also have to separately pay the estate $360,000, and Marvin Gaye's family gets 50% of the song's royalties. So what's interesting and not particularly surprising, there's been a lot of press, both in the legal blogs as well as among singers and songwriters and musicians about the potential impact of this case and its impact on creativity. What's interesting is I actually think that the songs are pretty close, and it just always reminds me of that Vanilla Ice, Ice Ice Baby, and the litigation with Queen.
Let's go right to the audio. Very high-tech audio here at Legal
Face. Yes, of course.
Right, so this is...
It's a high-budget production here.
Which one do you think that is?
Marvin Gaye.
That's Marvin Gaye.
Everybody get up.
What's the verdict? Let's have our own little jury here. Jasmine
Same thing.
Cooper?
Same thing.
Same thing, right?
Same thing.
Brian?
It seems like the same music. And I was going to ask Tina, I mean, you know, it seems like every rap song deals with another song.
Well, that's sampling, right?
Well, that's called
right?
sampling.
Sampling. So that's the difference.
And they get permission for that.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, if they're smart, they get it, because especially if they're lifting a song completely, which they often are, there's really no debating whether or not that's a copyright infringement without permission, so...
It's the exact same song, basically. I mean, here's
Literally.
The thing. Here's the thing. Like,
it seems
all music is copied at some point, right? All
right.
music... A bedrock principle of, like, especially pop music, is that there's nothing original. At some point, you could call it inspired by, you could call it copy other artists. The question is, how litigious are you going to get, and how close is it? There's so many famous cases of this. One of the most prominent ones is I Want a New Drug by Huey Lewis and Ghostbusters by Ray Parker back in the day. That was like a famous lawsuit.
Well, yeah, don't forget Ice Ice Baby and Under Pressure.
Well, that was an actual sample. They actually sampled
no,
the music from...
Well, actually, Vanilla Ice said that the songs were not similar at all. And then he mentioned like one note out of the chorus that was different. And he's like, they're completely different.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think this case does have a chilling effect. Somewhat, on the other hand...
Yeah, for those who are, like, copying others out there.
No, but I mean...
Just get it approved.
It's so clearly, though, a copy in this case. I think it's like...
Just get a license.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to another case that has been on the news involving... Who wants to sing the Bears theme song? Brian?
Bear down.
There you go.
Chicago Bears.
The Chicago Bears, the newly crowned NFC... North or NFC Central champion. Is it now called the North or the Central?
North.
It is called the North.
Go Bears.
Mm-hmm. Used to be the Central. Bears. Big win over the weekend against the despicable, hated Packers. Brian McManus was there. I unfortunately was not there, but...
You're being a good dad instead.
Yes. A federal court judge ruled last week that Russell Beckman, who is a Bears season ticket holder...
And former star of LFO.
Yes.
We've talked about this guy.
Yes, yes, yes. We've talked about this case in the past. But Beckman won the chance to be on the Bears sideline. As a season ticket holder, you can purchase the opportunity to be on the sideline. And Beckman decided to wear Packers gear on the sideline. Well, the Bears policy did not permit that. They did not allow him to do that. So he sued the Bears in federal court. His theory was that The Bears are a public entity because they're part of the Chicago Park District. In other words, Soldier Field is on Chicago Park District land, and he should be allowed to freely express himself and wear what he wants. The Bears, on the other hand, said that they are a private team. They have the right to produce a product that they want to and in the manner they want to, and they should, you know, if you're a Packers fan, wear what you want in the stadium. We don't have to allow you to stand on the sideline with, you know, 99.9% of everyone else wearing Bears colors and uniforms. Well, Judge Joan Gottschall, on Thursday of last week, in a 21-page order here in the U.S. District Court, refused to grant the request by Beckman to stand on the sideline. She said it was a closed case, actually. She said that the Bears did not say in their brief with specificity how they would be harmed by this. But she did say that the Bears appear to believe that seeing a person wearing Packers gear in the end zone will hamper their fans' enjoyment of the game. And while it was a close case, she would not allow Beckman to proceed with his lawsuit, allowing him to wear that. So, in many ways, kind of a dumb waste of time.
Yeah, we're talking about an illegal face-off.
Is this an important First Amendment case? His attorney, by the way, has said that he will continue, that he will appeal it. And because it's a closed case, the tie should go to the runner and allow his client to wear what he wants. Tina, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I remember when we talked about this case when it first started a number of months ago. I think it's actually been close to a couple of years at this point. And I remember thinking then what I think now, which is at the end of the day, the Bears can mandate what they want to see with respect to people who appear on the field. I think it's one thing if you're a fan who shows up to the game and you pay a ticket price and you wear what you want to wear. But I side with the Bears on this. So.
Bears.
Jasmine,
what if Coach Ditka was a lawyer and he was going up against the greatest lawyers of all time and you had a jury full of Ditkas?
I just think this is totally a waste
Ditka
of time.
Lawyer. So waste of time?
Waste of time.
If you were on this jury, would you side in favor of the Bears or this Packers fan?
Well, I agree with Tina. The Bears, I feel like, have a right to say what they don't want on their, I want to say property, but I just don't think that's right. It's dumb to me.
All right, Brian, come on. This is a layup for McManus.
Hey, there's a lot of
career Bears fan, right?
There's a lot of protected classes in this country. People, sexes, age, race. Being a Packers fan
is
not a protected class.
The Bears. Another vote in favor of the greatest team in the history of all football and all sports. Bears.
Hail Ditka.
Hey, that's a baker's dozen, Bab. All right. let's move on to the Carlton dance, right? Carlton dance is from what? Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Yes.
Alfonso Ribeiro.
It's Ribeiro.
I think it's Ribeiro.
I think it's Ribeiro.
Anyone?
In Espanol.
I don't know.
Let's call him Carlton.
Okay, we'll call him Ribeiro.
There's a lawsuit involving Carlton. He's alleging that his dance was stolen, yes?
He is.
More IP news for Tina Martini.
Yes, because the world is all about IP. So we'll call him Carlton. He sued in a California federal court earlier this week, alleging that game makers Epic Games and Take-Two Interactive infringed the copyright that he owns in the dance that he made famous, the Carlton Dance. He claims that in the fighting game Fortnite, which has been created by these two game makers, that there are characters that show the dance moves and stole his dance moves from his signature routine. He claims that the dance has become synonymous with him. It's part of his identity. And whenever somebody sees someone dancing the dance, they immediately think of him. So what's interesting is that there are a couple of other celebrities who are also suing these game makers in similar lawsuits, also claiming that their famous dance routines have been lifted and characters are making their moves in these games as well. So Carlton is seeking a share in the profits that the game makers have earned with the video game. I would predict out-of-court settlements on these.
Jasmine, are you a Fortnite fan?
All you kids are
Fortnite fans.
I know what it is, but I've never played it. I never played it a day in my life.
Are you a fan of the Carlton Dance? You were doing some. Let's see some of the Carlton Dance.
Just a little swing here and there, okay. You know, just to keep it jazzy.
Brian, I know you love the Fortnite and Carlton. Should he get a piece of the pie here? What do you think?
You know, Rich, I'm just happy that they're talking about a show that was on when you and I were in high school.
Yeah.
But, you know, what Tina made the point about Marvin Gaye seems to be completely the case here as well.
Right. So let's listen to a little bit of the famous song that accompanies the dance, right? All right, let's go to our last story, A War on Christmas. What is the world coming to, Tina, when the Christmas season is fraught with not sugar plums and partridges, but litigation?
Well, this is why people have invented Festivus for the rest of us, because this is what the world's come to. So late last month, Idaho resident Jeremy Morris won a lawsuit against his homeowners association for discrimination in what has been termed discrimination not only against him, but his family's Christian religion. And he was awarded $60,000 in compensatory damages and $15,000 in punitive damages. The battle started when Morris decided to be proactive and reached out to the homeowners association as he was buying his home to let them know that he planned to decorate his house in a festive Yuletide tradition of lights and music. The homeowners association wrote him a letter back saying that by doing so, he'd be violating the homeowners association rules, and that there was a concern that there are some non-Christian, non-believing residents who may not want to partake in this Yuletide tradition. Well, Morris decided to decorate his house anyway, and there was some pretty heavy resistance from some of his neighbors, including yelling and screaming and kicking of his car. So this has now been termed a war on Christmas. He sued this the homeowners association and decided that he will take the proceeds from his winnings and he will move elsewhere with the money that he has gotten. So I think it's probably a good idea for him to move at this point.
I hate these stories of, like, you know, people just going crazy on their homes of these crazy decorations and lawsuits. Like, although I am the guy in my neighborhood who went a little nuts at Halloween, so maybe my neighbors are preparing a lawsuit for next year. But Jasmine, what do you think? Should you be able to regulate your neighbors' decorations?
From this picture, it really doesn't look like all that bad to me.
There are some crazier ones that you've seen, right?
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah, stuff all over the lawn, you know, like screaming,
yeah,
Santa Clauses,
right.
You know, it doesn't look that bad to me. It's excessive, of course, but honestly, I don't feel like it's that bad.
McManus, how many times have you been sued by your neighbors for your decorations at your house? Because I know you go a little nuts.
Not yet. They're probably getting some going right now. I mean, this looks like, it doesn't look like Clark Griswold's house. And, you know, Christianity, Judaism, those are protected classes. So if this guy wants to celebrate Christmas the way he wants to celebrate Christmas, I think that's within his right.
Is he entitled to create a nuisance, though?
Well, I certainly don't think that, at least the picture that we have, would constitute a nuisance.
What if they played
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer 24 hours a day?
That would be a nuisance.
Right.
What if I'm a Buddhist or an atheist and I don't want to deal with these decorations, Tina?
Well, then don't look that direction. But I can understand where it comes to a point if it's super excessive, you know, a la Christmas Vacation, that, you know, that it could be, you know, like, for example, someone's afraid of getting electrocuted or something arcing if they walk across the street. I mean, that's a bad, bad situation.
All right, well, since you mentioned Christmas Vacation, we have to go around the room and ask everyone's favorite holiday movie, put you on the spot. Tina Martini, and don't say Christmas Vacation because you just said
it. Well, it is one of mine. I have a few. I have a few of Christmas Story.
We've got a time limit here, Tina Martini.
I love one of the original versions of A Christmas Carol.
Uh-huh.
And the 1950s version. And I also love Sleepless in Seattle, which David and I term a Christmas movie.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Because it starts off at Christmas.
Very good. Jasmine, favorite holiday movie or Christmas movie?
This is hard. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Ah.
Gotta do a
Claymation. Claymation. Gotta do a classic.
Brian McManus?
No doubt the Red Ryder action pump. Airgun BB.
Christmas Story?
Christmas Story.
the tongue on the pole is classic.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
How about Ben Anderson? Natalie Clad, producer and lover of all things Christmas.
There is no contest. Die Hard.
That's nice. Not a Christmas movie.
Die Hard a Christmas movie.
I mean, let's look at the facts here. You know, everybody said it just happened to happen at Christmas. I was like, all right, they could have left him home alone on spring break.
That's true.
Right. Ben, I'm just going to let you have it. It's fine. I'm tired of this argument. Every year is the same argument. I'm tired. So
I'm very partial.
You've worn them out.
As a Jewish American man, I'm very partial to the Eight Crazy Nights, the famous Adam Sandler movie. And then the Hebrew Hammer is a close second. Anyone know the Hebrew Hammer? Go check it out. Bob Coyne knows it very well back there. Well, friends, let's take this moment and say happy holidays, however you celebrate it. Another
Festivus
great year comes to a close on Legal Face-Off. And any parting thoughts, Tina Martini?
I'm very excited about bringing in 2019.
Big plans for 2019. What's a Tina Martini New Year's Eve look like? You and David Sussler planning the next Inside Out column?
Yeah,
we
sit at the dining room table and we knock it out on New Year's Eve. I'm getting together with family and just grabbing dinner, and then we may have a Monty Python marathon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll be there. Well,
what are you doing, Richie Rich?
Jasmine Cooper, you'll have to see on that one.
Stay
Jasmine
tuned.
Cooper.
I just plan on relaxing. I actually have the next 2 weeks off after Friday.
Good
so
for you.
I really just want to take time off and put my feet up.
Well, well deserved. Thanks for joining us. Brian McManus.
Happy holidays to everybody, Rich and everyone. Thank you so much. And go Bears.
Tell us the
go
website. Bears. Tell us the website one more time. If you remember it. Uh-oh. Put him on the spot.
www.mcmanuslawfirm.com.
All right, Ben Anderson, thanks as always. Bob Coyne back there poking his head, thank you. Tina Martini, thank you. Sam Panianich decided not to join us again, but we thank him wherever he is.
And we thank you, Richie Rich.
Thank you. We'll see you in 2019 on Legal Face-Off.
WGN Radio.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going.